Thank you. So the talk will be review in nature, and so I'm going to review some stuff. I will put some new things, but mainly it would be a review of recent years, and hopefully I would like to come with a more generalized concept. I thought this would be most appropriate since most of the audience is actually theoretician. So maybe they will find some use of what I'm going to say. So the textbook view of a neuron, and the textbook and the people who work on neuronal modeling of networks have a very simplistic view of the single neuronal element. Usually it would be an integrate and fire neuron, meaning that it will sum its input linearly and will have a single non-linearity that will produce the action potentials of the neurons, the output. And if you look at the textbook view of how, for example, receptive fields are formed in the visual cortex, simple cells and complex cells, it would be actually a specific connectivity of very simple neuronal elements, which are in principle devoted of dendrites. So this view is really simplistic and far away from realistic neurons that we know. We know that neurons are complicated creatures with possessing large dendritic arborization. And we heard from Jeff 2 days ago that just by taking into account the passive structure of the neuron, it is already imposing some interesting spatial-temporal integration modes. But on top of that, we know the dendrites also have active nonlinear conductances such as sodium, calcium, NMDA, and a huge plethora of potassium channels, eight channels. All these enrich considerably the processing capability of such a neuron. So basically, what we are interested in is understanding the input-output function of this realistic neuron, and especially understanding how the dendrites process their vast synaptic input. So they receive approximately a typical pyramidal neuron would receive typically 10,000 synapses distributed on the dendritic tree and will integrate in time and space to form the output of the neuron. And the basic belief is that if we understand how dendrite process their information, we'll have better understanding of the encoding and decoding schemes of information in the cortical tissue, hopefully understanding better sensory and motor integration in the cortex. Most of the work I've done in recent years was at the primary slices from primary somatosensory cortex. And we mainly concentrated, although not exclusively, on the layer 5 pyramidal neuron. And the fact we concentrated on the layer 5 pyramidal neurons is just simple because it is a large neuron, which was the easiest one to record from. So performing dendritic recordings is very complicated, very difficult. And actually, already recording from these big neurons posed a significant challenge. The layer 5 pyramidal neuron is the largest neuron of the cortical hemisphere. It spans all cortical layer from layer 6 to up to layer 1. So throughout its vast dendritic arborization, it collects information from all cortical layers. And actually, this is the neuron which forms the output of the out of the cortical hemisphere. So this neuron can be regarded to be as performing a complex feature integration of the information it receives. It typically has two main dendritic arborizations: the basal arborization, which receives 80% of the total synapses to the neuron, 70 to 80%. and the tuft arborization, which stems from the main apical dendrites and bifurcates at all the way up to layer one. It receives 10 to 15% of the total synaptic contacts to the neuron and is densely innervated by feedback long-range information. So it will process mainly top-down information. And when we started recording from dendrites, most of the information came from the main apical dendrite. Almost 100% of recordings were made from the apical dendrites. And I would like to actually describe two main findings. So Jeff already mentioned that, but I would like to give So the first important finding was that action potentials generated at the axisomatic region backpropagate to apical dendrites. But here what I'm showing actually is that in mature animals, and the first work that was described from the Sackmann's lab really worked on young animals. But when one do the same experiment on mature animals, young adult animals, one can see that these backpropagating action potentials attenuate significantly as they propagate. And actually up there, the voltage is a very small voltage left. At the tuft region, now we know that almost this backpropagating action potential is not invading. So I think this is an important information for those who really use spike timing dependent plasticity to take into considerations that there are large segments of the neuron that actually do not really feel the backpropagating action potential. Important finding, I think, is the fact that we found that this neuron actually has two main integration zones. One zone, of course, was known. Yes. Yeah, but I'm not showing, but I hope it will be more understandable. You do get, I mean, feedback information from the soma is being related to this initiation zone. And I think I will talk about it a little bit. So everything to the tuft is actually related through this second integration zone and is not directly related to the tuft through the axisomatic region. Because backpropagating action potentials do not make it there. But we know that backpropagating action potentials interact with the calcium initiation zone. Yes, yes. And eventually, this interaction of the backpropagating action potentials with the calcium initiation zone eventually produces this large calcium spike, and if large enough, it can forward propagate to the to this compartment and causes a large burst formation. So you do communicate, but not directly.
And they also backpropagate.
Yes, I will show that. I will show that, yeah, I will show that. So it is a complicated neuron. You have to take, I mean, this neuron is more than 1 millimeter in rat and more than 3 to 4 millimeters in human. And actually, as I will show, it is basically even can be viewed as being two neurons connected through this main road, the main apical dendrite. So here what we did really long time ago is stimulated tuft dendrites, and we could see very clearly that a spike is generated We later showed that this spike, the main charge carrier was through voltage-gated calcium channels, and these spikes can have different degrees of propagation. In this case, it stayed localized to distal apical dendrites, but in many cases, it can propagate all the way forward to the soma. So obviously there are many more findings related to the main apical dendrite, but I don't want to concentrate today on these findings, on reviewing the main apical dendrite. Rather, I would like to concentrate on integration being performed in basal and tuft dendrites. And the main reason I was after these dendrites is that, as I said, together, inputs to the tuft and basal dendrites is form the majority of inputs to these dendrites. More than 90% of inputs are formed on the thin branches. And knowing that dendrites are not homogeneous in their characteristics, it was very, you cannot record from location in apical dendrite and actually know what's happening in the distal dendrite or in the tuft or basal, because it's just non-homogeneous. And if you want to know what's happening in a certain portion of this tree, you have to go ahead and investigate it directly. But this, yes. Yes, I'll come to it. It can. So,
I don't want to get off on a side thing, but what is the nature of input onto the apical, this long apical dendrite? Because it seems to me that synaptic conductance there can telescope or bring closer or farther this distant tree.
You mean which input?
Onto the
main shaft.
The main shaft itself.
I don't think it is really very known. There is one work from the Svobodas group, which I'll come to it at the end, who really used channel rhodopsin labeled axons. And I'll show it later, but I don't think that presently we really know what inputs are segregated exactly at basal and apical and so on. But I think many labs are working on that. But if you look at it, as I said, I think there are spines on the shaft, but it would be like less than 10% of the all the total that the neuron is receiving.
Synaptic conductance,
yes,
in that area could have a
huge impact. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I hope to show that. Yeah. So this recording from this thin dendrites is really a big challenge. We are talking about dendrites with the caliber of a micron or less. And so we had to, at the beginning, we had to find other ways to probe these dendrites. And my lab and other labs used indirect methods to probe these dendrites. Some of them are, for example, recording calcium from shafts and spines from basal and tuft dendrites, combined with focal stimulation to activate these spines. We used also one photon and two photon uncaging of glutamate to activate specific regions of these dendrites, combined with somatic recordings. People try to use voltage-sensitive dyes. All of these methods enriched our knowledge, but they had their own advantages, but also disadvantages. But most importantly, we could not answer very basic questions about basal and tuft dendrites using these indirect methods. Fortunately, we started using a new method described in this paper, Wimmer et al., which is really not a complicated optical method. It combines scanned dot contrast image, which is abundant in many microscopes, which creates a contrast image of our slice. But the same light that really we are using for two-photon imaging, we usually load our neurons and with fluorescent dye to visualize the dendrites. So what we are getting with this method is a perfect overlay of the two-photon fluorescent image and of the contrast image, as is seen here. And this enables us to visualize these fine dendrites. And with a specific usage of small electrodes, we could now robustly target these dendrites. So one of the main problems is just in normal contrast imaging, you don't see these fine dendrites. This is a major challenge, okay? You just don't see them properly. So the detection of these dendrites by the combined contrast image and fluorescent image was a breakthrough from our point of view to record from these fine dendrites. I can assure you still this is a, these are very difficult experiments, but doable. So this would be similar to a Nomarski image or to a DIC image. So you have here a contrast. Excuse me? The two photon is a fluorescent technique, okay? So here, what you get here is a fluorescent labeling of your processes. Basically, you cannot patch a dendrite just by fluorescent imaging. This is extremely hard, almost impossible. You need to have your contrast image up and blow it up in order to really do the patch physically. Not because of light, just because of the illusion. When you have a fluorescent image, the boundaries of the structure are not real boundaries. And when you go and target a structure which is less than a micron, you really want to know where are your boundaries. Otherwise, you are chasing... Yes. Okay. So that's the layout, which I hope to get into all the sections. And so I would like to show properties and integration principles that we now know after recording from directly from basal dendrites. Later on, I will show our recent findings from tough dendrites. And hopefully, I will get to this section. And I would like to propose a generalized biophysical scheme of this neuron. And discuss with you also some possible integration modes that can be performed by this layer 5 pyramidal neuron. Okay, so basal dendrites. First question, and David was asking me, what about backpropagating action potentials to basal dendrites? So when we started this project, state of the art was that people who used voltage-sensitive dyes claimed that there is full propagation of action potentials to basal dendrites, and people who used calcium-sensitive dyes claimed that there is a huge attenuation of the backpropagating action potentials to basal dendrites. So what we decided to do is actually record from the soma and the section of a basal dendrite and deliver current pulses to the soma to generate these action potentials, the train and a single action potential. And in blue, you can see the voltage to the soma, red, the voltage at the dendrite. And you can already see that there is attenuation of the backpropagating action potentials to the basal dendrites. So after around 100 micron away from the soma, which is, I would say, half the size of basal dendrites at this age, the backpropagating action potential attenuate by about 50% of its original size. Here, the dotted line shows the backpropagating action potentials at apical dendrites, and I will show it here in more clearly. So here what you see is the plot for basal dendrites in black and the plot for apical dendrites in dotted lines as a function of the absolute physical distance. and here as a function of the normalized distance. And we measured our dendrites to be around 200 micron in length for basal and 1,200 for apical. And you can see here a nice feature that per dendritic distance, there is, of course, much more attenuation in basal dendrites compared to apical dendrites. But when we normalize the size, we can see that actually these two trees, although they have very different sizes, okay, they electrically, with respect to backpropagating action potentials, they are quite comparable. What about synaptic properties? Actually, this was not known at all for basal dendrites. Even simple question of what is the size of the unitary event, the degree of attenuation, whether there is scaling or not, as in CA1 pyramidal neuron, it was not known. And this is what we wanted to investigate. So what we did here is, in addition to recording from the soma and the dendrite, we puffed sucrose nearby our recording electrode. And so this had a huge advantage since we had a really good control over the generation of this unitary event. So usually people in the literature would sort this unitary event by rise time and so on. But with this method, you really can get a localized initiation of this synaptic event nearby the recording electrode. Of course, we also used spontaneous event and sorted them up just to see whether it is comparable, and the results are comparable. So in control conditions, you have this spontaneous event, and the other advantage is with sucrose, of course, what you get is a higher frequency, so you don't need to record for many minutes in order to get enough data. So already, when seeing this simple recording, two things are evident. First is the large amplitude of these events at basal dendrites. You can see that these events can reach even 6 millivolts or more locally in voltage. And the second feature is the huge attenuation. So sitting at the soma, you actually cannot guess that you have such large events at the dendrite.
What causes this? And what are they more frequency
with sucrose? With sucrose, this is something that was found at, for the neuromuscular junction long way ago. And I think what is claimed is that you have an osmotic effect on the release mechanisms that causes spontaneous release of vesicles. But we did sort the spontaneous event just to see that we are not bullshitting, more or less. So, okay, so you can see it here for the average size at this location, at this experiment for the unitary event. You can see the attenuation. This is a blue somatic recording and red dendritic recording. And again, I would like to show the attenuation ratio for basal dendrites, which was, at around mid-size of basal dendrite, it reached around 40, which is quite large. And in dotted lines, you can see, again, the situation for apical dendrite. These data are taken from Williams and Stewart, who did that for the apical dendrite. And again, same feature. So the electrical size of basal dendrites is equal to the electrical size of apical dendrites with respect to synaptic events. So it is interesting that the tree really normalizes its sizes with respect to backpropagating action potential, but also with respect to the attenuation of synaptic events originating in basal dendrites and apical dendrites. Again, this is, does not include the tough dendrites. All these data are taken, if you can see here the dotted lines, are taken more or less up to the first bifurcation point. Okay, so if we are talking, I think both. So for a unitary event, I would say passive considerations. because I don't think you get to the threshold or to activate much of the voltage-gated sodium and calcium channels. But for backpropagating action potentials, we do know that there are active processes. But it's interesting. So also for backpropagating action potentials, there is this, scaling and normalization, taking into account also active processes to normalize the size of the basal and apical tree. Something, yeah. It's not. This is. Yes. Yes. Yes.
Jackie, when you're comparing the action potentials and the unitary synaptic events, the distance at which things propagate passively depend on the rapidity of the change. The high frequency to attenuate a lot more. Did you ever work it out so you could normalize for the rates of change?
That's a good point. At this point, we just worked with single action potentials and single unitary events. But it's a really good point to know the frequency characteristics of attenuation. We didn't do it, yet.
Yeah, in the data for the apical dendrites, where are the synapses? If you say that the tough side is involved. So where are these synapses that
Well, you have spines in
on the
apical. You have spines. It's not very dense, but you do have, as I said, about 10% of the spines would be in the spread in the apical shaft. So Williams and Stewart, what they did in these experiments, they used blockers. GABA blockers to initiate, many unitary events and sorted them out. This is what they did.
So this 10% is basically either
a
higher density or just because there's more surface on the top?
There is, much more surface. Yeah. You don't get high. I mean, the densest spines are at the basals. And Taft is more sparse, and also the shaft is more sparse.
The vertical axis on the graph, the PPS of the dendrite, is that percentage or is that a multiplier? We have 10.
It's a division. I mean, we divided the sizes. Yes. So, and next, there was out there the data by the group of Jeff McGee that showed very nicely how the size of the unitary events actually scale up. And this scaling is active, meaning that there are more AMPA receptors along the apical tree of CA1 pyramidal neurons to compensate for the losses, as Jeff showed very nicely in his talk. And we wanted to see what's happening in basal dendrites, and for that, we simply did this experiment recording from two locations and puffing at two locations, so we know the generation of minis at each location. And we ask, what is the size? So now this is not attenuation to the soma. This is minis that are initiated nearby each recording electrode. And we can see here in red the distal electrode and in black the more proximal electrode. And here we can see that the more distally born units have significantly larger amplitude compared to the more proximal, which is very similar to what Jeff's data. Interestingly, we can see here, similar to what happens in CA1, that the contribution to the soma is actually very similar for distally born EPSPs and proximally born EPSPs, the unitary events.
The distal ones are much slower.
Basal dendrites are, I think you have little load because they are very thin and you don't have much capacitance and they are really short.
No, I mean slower when you quarter at the soma. Wouldn't you expect them to be slower when you quarter at the soma?
They are a little bit slower. So if you compare the blue, yeah, this is what you have. That's a really good point. That's a really good point. But I'll tell you what, we did such experiments, especially for the Tuft, because the referee asked us to do that. But we were terrified because to get a really good voltage clamp from these really small electrodes, high input resistances, I don't know that I would trust the data. And this was our main problem here, that we, you know, preferred to record voltage and not current, although current would be here very informative, of course. We want to know the current, not only the voltage. But doing patch clamp, doing voltage clamp with such conditions seemed to us not very reliable. That's the main point. Yes.
But each one of those problems can be studied so you can understand how big it is. And you can't, and just making the voltage, you can't tell how much of it is because the currents are different, the synapses are bigger, and how much of it is just
Sure. I agree. I mean, here we didn't have the current, and it's a big problem. We did some experiments for the TAF to measure the current. We were very cautious about our conclusions because every modeler would tell you, don't voltage clamp. Small.
But the biophysicists like the voltage clamp.
I like the voltage clamp.
They like to study what the artifacts are so they know what they can believe and what they can't believe. But it's a lot easier to interpret.
Maybe we should do that. I think we used modeling, I will show, to maybe overcome some of these questions, but I agree. The best is to have a reliable measurement of the current.
If you put in a capacitive block to improve your spacecraft, you put cesium in the electrode to improve the spacecraft, and your voltage clamp spontaneous activity, almost all of it is coming from the space of dendrites, then you can parse out the rise times. And they seem to fall into NMDA and AMPA groups. But there's,
you cannot differentiate.
You cannot say anything that gives you a hint that you can differentiate distal when we haven't looked at specifically along the dendrite, but you can't find anything that would suggest that there's
anything different distal
and thing.
Well, it should, because if you look at the synapses, they're the same all along.
Right.
You mean the spines, or just look at the size of the side?
Yeah.
They look pretty much the same.
Yeah. So this would be our conclusion. And yes. Good point. True. Good point. But I hope towards the end of my talk I will convince you that there is more to it. It's published. Okay, so, but again, as you pointed out, since we don't have here current, we really don't know whether this scaling up is passive or active. And so, as many times, what we do.
One question back here.
Yes. Oh, yeah. So here you have a summary plot. We did that for many distances and for many dendrites, and this is a summary. So we have fourfold in amplitude of distal versus proximal regions, while if you look at the contribution to the soma, So interestingly, you can see that throughout a majority of the lengths, there is very little change except for the first 50, 60 microns. And overall, if you take the whole range, this would be around two-fold difference compared to around four-fold difference. So it's not a perfect normalization as was shown by Jeff McGee for CA1 pyramidal neurons, but if we discard the first 50 microns throughout the, almost the entire length of the dendrite, you will have really very nice normalization or contribution, similar contribution to the somatic voltage. So again, we had to turn to simulations to try to tease out the components and see whether... Yes. For a single EPSP, for a single unitary spontaneous event. Yes, yes. So from what you see from patch recordings of pairs, you see sometimes 0.5 millivolts, and even you have pairs of even 1 millivolt, right? So what I would like to comment about it is that you have more than one synapse, obviously. So you have, I don't know how many, because also it depends on how well you do the EM. Maybe you have more than 5, 6 that they claim. Maybe you have more. But also, I think maybe there is some selection bias also, because you look for the connection, and so you do few runs and you decide, okay, these are connected pairs or not. So maybe you tend to take the stronger pairs compared to the weaker pairs. And here we don't choose. We just take everything. Yeah, yeah. No, you have here, well, less than half a millivolt, but you definitely have point here. Oh, no, you have still, this is still, you know, a size you can measure and small. Yeah. So there is a bias, of course, because I here with the small event, it's very hard to, I mean, there is some noise to the system. So I don't see the whole tail of the small events. I do see the tail of the big events. So it's skewed, I think, just because of technical reasons. That's a good point, but this is because the membrane is really fluid and flexible. So, there are patch clampers here in the audience? Mike? Known patch clamper? So, you know, when you do and try to patch clamp, we all look for the membrane to do a bleed, to open up in order to seal. So what you see is really that the membrane is very niftach.
The membrane, for some unknown reason, seals to the tip, and it probably causes a deformation of the surface. You don't know exactly what's going on.
Yes.
It probably causes a deformation of the place, but then you're looking from that area to the area you need to be engaged in.
Well, a lot of times, when you make the seal, you suck up a piece of the membrane up into the electrode. It's a long piece sometimes. So the membrane is so flexible that when you suck it up...
Yeah, flexible, that's
right. The electrode goes up like this, and it'll suck up a point. If you have the right situation, you can walk up.
Well, there's not much width, but it's kind of long.
So you have enough membrane to suck. Of course, all our recordings are up to around 150 microns, which was the limit that we could reach, because then it tapers on off more and more and more, and it becomes very difficult, really about less than the size of the electrode, and this is really very difficult. Now, this is a very difficult mission because you have the dendrite is like a road, and you have to catch it. It's not very easy. It slips. It's very difficult. Like what people do with axons? I'm not sure, because we really wanted to know what's happening along the way. We wanted to be more, flexible in our picking up of regions. And so we actually did not want to work on cut dendrites deliberately. But maybe to really reach to the end of the dendrite, maybe you have to do that. I don't know. Or my hope is that voltage-sensitive dye imaging or other imaging techniques would get better, and this would be the best if we could do that like that. Okay, so we turn to model our system, and here every solid line shows one dendrite, and I think our modeling data really capture most of the experimental data, with the fourfold difference between distal and proximal regions. If we look here at the somatic correlate, we can see that almost throughout the length of dendrites, it is quite similar in contribution, except the first 50 or so microns. So we're quite happy about the simulations. And what we did next is scaled up or down, the linearly scaled up or down, the AMPA receptors.
Can you say two words? When you put it on, how it was constructed?
Again? How it was constructed? So every neuron that we recorded from, we reconstructed with biocytine. We knew exactly which dendrite we recorded from and where. So we had full anatomical and experimental data. Here we used a neuron platform with compartmental modeling. We know from our recordings the passive properties, and also we had towards the end of the experiments, we had also active properties that I will show that we inserted into the model. So all this together was the skeleton of the model. And then we reconstructed our voltage unitary recording from... No, it's a multi-compartmental model. It's true model of the entire neuron and dendrite. Yeah. It's a true. We took the real neuron. It's not a ball and stick or Yes. So the red is the dendritic recording and the blue is the somatic correlate for each dendrite. This is a blow up of this portion. So if you look here, scaling up or down the AMPA receptors linearly really just do not match our experimental data. The experimental data matches best with passive model of 100, not scaling up or scaling down the concentration or density of AMPA receptor along basal dendrite. So our conclusion here is, in contrast, a linear gradient. So in contrast to CA1 pyramidal neurons, well, actually to get these changes in size and to get normalization at the soma, you need to insert AMPA receptors throughout the length to get this normalization. in basal dendrites and actually also in apical dendrites from Williams and Stewart data. They have the same conclusion that in layer 5 pyramidal neurons, just the passive properties of the neurons just endow you with this feature. Yes, yes, yes. So, almost in, throughout the entire length, except the first 50 microns.
So the differentiation is in that wavelength
sense is
more dendrite based than it is from one synapse to another
one. Maybe there are local, you know, maybe there are local learning rules, or I don't know. But just looking at the data. So what is the explanation of this shape? We can say that from our modeling, to understand the shape, we have to take into account two main considerations. So this drop at the first 100 micron of the dendritic segment is caused by the huge load of the soma, sink of the soma, and by proximal bifurcation of basal dendrites. And here, this rise towards the end of the dendrite is caused by the sealed ends of the dendritic branches. And what about the soma? So actually, what this tells you is what modelers have been saying long ago about basal dendrites, is that there is a nice current conservation flowing from distal parts of the dendrites to more proximal parts of the dendrites up to the soma. And this explains why throughout the almost entire length you have same contribution to the soma, except the first 50 to 60 microns, probably because of the if one looks at this neuron, you can see that most of the bifurcations of the neuron is at the first 50 micron portion of the dendrite, of the apical dendrite. So there you have a large flow of current to neighboring areas, not reaching, some reaching the soma, some just flowing to neighboring portions. And this is why one has this decrease. So my interpretation is that the difference for layer 5 compared to CA1 pyramidal neurons, and I was discussing that with Jeff 2 days ago, is actually because of the anatomy of these neurons. So if one looks at CA1 pyramidal neurons, it is a densely branched neuron. So it has many obliques, starting from the soma all the way up, while layer 5 pyramidal neuron is very different. It has few branches at the beginning, and then you have this highway, this long road, almost without any branching, and basals as well. They branch at the beginning, and then you have long terminal ends of more than 100 micron. So I think the load is just smaller compared to CA1 pyramidal neuron.
But there's more than one kind of CA1 pyramidal neuron, both morphologically and physiologically. And the question is, are all of these the same kind? And sort of
the layer 5 that we use?
Yeah.
Or you use a specific, yeah, we use the thick tufted layer 5 pyramidal neurons.
The thick tufted.
The thick tufted. So the one that go all the way up to layer 1 and branch and have a large tuft.
There's another, there are other layer 5 pyramidal neurons,
yes,
that also go all the way,
but have a smaller tuft.
That have a smaller tuft and a smaller basal dendrite.
Yeah. So we used the really large, the big ones. Yeah. No. Well, no. Everything is a model here. Here, what we do is actually take the curve, the experimental curve, this curve is a modeling curve, but created by match our experimental data. And what we do is scale up or down linearly the AMPA receptors along the basal dendrite. And this shows for dendritic sites, and this is for the somatic correlate. These are just multiple dendrites that we recorded from. It is a reconstruction of our experimental data. So this is a model which reconstructed our experimental data. Yes, we actually took true geometries from our, we took the real morphology and all the dendrites that we recorded from. Yes, yes. Average, grand average. Okay, so to wrap up this part, we looked at the actually backward propagation of unitary events. So propagation of events from the soma, obviously coming from other dendrites to the soma, to the site we recorded from. And we can see that the back propagation is quite well. Only a small attenuation throughout the large distance of basal dendrites. And so this is also not a big surprise and is expected from just from passive considerations. Okay. So what about active integration in basal dendrites? And this is for you. You are still here. What? Okay. So up to now, really, we've seen that the electrical and passive properties of this basal and apical are trying to match up for backpropagating action potential and for small unitary events. But what I would like to show is that these dendrites are way more complicated. If you look at the synapse per synapse, this is true. But if one starts to look at interactions between synapses, then suddenly you realize that these dendrites really are more complicated, and they know how to do regenerative events also. So what we did here is injected a current similar to what we did for apical dendrite, recorded from the soma in blue, and injected current at a location of a basal dendrite, and this is shown in red. And what you can see here is increasing intensity of our injections. So you can see that at a certain intensity, a sodium spikelet is initiated, and this was attenuated significantly at the soma. If you remember from Jeff's recording at CA1 pyramidal neurons, and also from our recording in CA1 pyramidal neurons, these sodium spikelets are way more stronger in CA1 neurons compared to layer 5 neurons. So here you have this huge attenuation of the sodium spikelets when they propagate to the soma. If you increase more the stimulus intensity, you see the back, you reach the threshold for the back propagating action potentials. You can see that in here in open circles. And so in the same recording session, we had the local spikelets and also the back propagating action potential, both at the dendrite and at the soma. So why this is sodium, you don't have to believe me, but if you look at the pharmacology, you would believe me. Cadmium and nickel, which are specific voltage-gated calcium channel blockers, do not change the spike. But look what's happening if we add on top of that TTX. This is the blue trace. It blocks completely the spike. So this is one example. Obviously, we had many of these examples. And so this is in sharp contrast to what you get in the apical dendrite. In the apical dendrite, when you inject current, typically you would get a calcium spike. In these recordings, we never could get a calcium spike when injecting current locally at the basal dendrite. The only spikelet that we could get with current injection was a sodium spikelet.
So the second aspect is the
The red here?
The same with the almost calcium-based, they are sodium-based.
They are sodium-based. And this you can see here, so... The backpropagating action potentials? This, of course, they are sodium-based. This we know. Not from this work. We know that from previously, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't have here the scale. I can fetch it. But this is a very fast event, like a 1 millisecond event, a very fast event. Between the spikelet and, well, these are generated at different locations, right? So the sodium spikelet is generated at the, locally at the dendrite, and the back, and the, these action potentials are really generated at the soma or the axon and just backpropagate. And at this distance, for sure, you even don't need any support of any sodium channel, and you will not even not see attenuation, only if you go further away. Yes, because this is exactly because what we've been talking about, that propagation from the soma to the dendrite is much better compared to propagation from the dendrite to the soma. And this is because you have a big structure propagating to a small structure, so you have large current propagating to a small dendrite, which is efficient. And the way around, you have a small dendrite with small current. Propagation is much harder. So open circles is the current voltage relationship for the backpropagating action potentials, and the closed circles for the local spike. The threshold for the local spike was smaller, obviously, because you inject. So again, we did some modeling, and I know that now Mike has direct experimental data maybe to support this. He will talk about it next week, I think. That actually, this is a really a good case where we can constrain our model, because we have both. We have the local event and we have the backpropagating event. And this is really a good situation where you can constrain your model. So we explored various scenarios, constant sodium distribution, along the basal dendrites, a proximal hotspot, a decaying sodium gradient, or increasing potassium gradient. And we looked what would give us the best match to our experimental data. In red is our experimental data. For sure, the passive case, which you see here, and the homogeneous case where there are sodium channels all the way from the proximal to the distal significantly deviate from our experimental data. And the best match was to either a proximal hotspot or a sodium gradient. So here we have a hint that sodium channels are non-homogeneously distributed along basal dendrites, and most probably you have a decaying gradient from the proximal to the distal region. This is a passive case.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I agree that it would be very hard to tell, and this was one of the problems. People, including myself, recorded the calcium before we could record voltage in basal dendrites. We recorded calcium transients evoked by backpropagating action potentials. But again, you couldn't tell if this is passive or active, because passive propagation could be just quite well to these small dendrites. But here we can definitely see the fact that you can evoke at the more proximal regions sodium spikelets, that there is active component to this propagation.
I think there is,
You could. You did pretty well. I agree. Because you don't have sodium electrogenesis, at least in the way we tried to evoke it with focal injections. I don't know what would happen. We try it. We are trying it. If you just gave a distributed input to these dendrites, sodium is quite weak there, right? And it's decaying. From my point of view, it's just maybe a developmental thing that you have a spa. I mean, the soma has a huge load of sodium channels, and the axon, and maybe this is, you know, some contamination from the soma, right? What? I mean, it didn't bother to really restrict it so very perfectly. And so these dendrites are quite passive in point of view of voltage-gated sodium and calcium channels. Yes, I agree. Completely. Yeah, because from one... Yes. Except that we had the sodium spikelet that we evoked. And so from one hand, you, at the same point, you evoke a sodium spikelet and you see the attenuation. And this was the your titration of the gradient. So we had to accommodate both. From one hand, this dendrite could evoke sodium spikelets of different sizes locally. But from the other hand, we know that the backpropagating action potential attenuated. So there must be some sodium decaying gradient or potassium increasing gradient to explain this. Yes, we explored many. I agree. And actually, this is what I did long ago when I was a postdoc with Sackman, when I did the recording of the calcium transients. So what we did is really voltage clamp the soma and recorded what's happening with the calcium. So there is a contribution of voltage-gated sodium channels, not a lot. And there is, for sure, clear decay of the backpropagating action potentials at basal dendrites. So, okay, are these dendrites passive to satisfy your models or not? And actually, zero is missing here. It's 2000. I'm not so old, yeah. I'm not a witch.
Although this was a good year in Israel.
זה המשנה, לא?
כן.
אוקיי. So we knew that although we could not evoke any regenerative events by current injections, but we knew from earlier work that by synaptic stimulation of axons contacting distal portions of basal dendrites, we could evoke very robust nonlinear events. And we term these events as NMDA spikes, and I hope I will convince you why we choose this name. And here, for the first time, we could actually record them directly via our patch electrodes. So here what you see is, just to show that we can stimulate nicely, we recorded from a dendrite and a soma and stimulated more distally. Here you can see a double pulse stimulation at 50 hertz, and this is a spontaneous event just happening there to show that our time courses and everything works quite well. And here, when you do the whole stimulation, I mean, increasing more and more the stimulus intensity, what you get is we get these all or none events that you can see here. In red, these are locally recorded. In blue, this is the somatic correlate. And you can get these plateau potentials, which are blocked completely. And you can see that in black, sorry about the quality, which are blocked completely by APV or MK81, which are specific blockers for NMDA receptor channels. Now, this the fact that you increase the stimulus intensity and actually increase the plateau potentials and only have a small modulation of the peak is expected from the properties of the NMDA receptor channels, which have really very long deactivation time constants. So all this matched nicely. Yes, yes. Or you can increase, I mean, if you block NMDA, you really limit the size of the EPSP you can get. So you can continue more and more, and there is a...
So what's the difference between the previous experiment?
The previous experiment, what we did is just injected current locally into dendrite. Here, this is a synaptic stimulation, releasing glutamate into the synaptic sites. So what I would like to show is to convince you that actually the main charge carrier of this spike is through the NMDA receptor channels. And what we did here is some uncaging experiments where we could evoke this nonlinearity and record it. By uncaging of glutamate, this enabled us to use all blockers that we wanted without interfering with transmitter release. So this is the control condition. This is what's happening when we put cadmium and nickel. I haven't showed, but I have the slides. If you put cadmium and nickel to a regenerative event in the apical dendrite, you block it completely. So we had a control that our cadmium and nickel really works nicely, and there is nothing bad with our drugs. And here you can see the comparison of control, cadmium, nickel, and APV. So APV really wipes out this spike. This is the current voltage relationship. So voltage-gated calcium channels do contribute somehow to the generation, because you can see that there is a shift in a right shift in the laser intensity. So the threshold is a little bit higher, but the main charge carrier is still through the NMDA receptor channels, and APV or MK-01 linearized completely the current voltage relationship, and you can go on and on. AMPA would saturate, actually, and there is a limit to what you could get with just AMPA. This is a regular type. Oh, let me show more data, and then we talk about it, okay? Then your question will be very relevant. This is at the SOMA, yeah. The same we can do also, now we have data also from recordings, local recordings. They do evoke burst, I will show that. And okay, this is just a summary of the pharmacology. This is just to show that it happens all along the basal branch. So here, this is for proximal regions, this is for distal regions. There is a trade-off. So the distal you are in the dendrite, so the less intensity of stimulation you need, but from the other hand, the contribution to the soma is smaller because of the attenuation. The more proximal you are, the stronger stimulation you need, more synapses you need to evoke this spike, but the contribution to the soma is huge at more proximal regions. So this is for you, David. this is under control conditions, and the blue here is with AMPA blockers. Okay, so you can get a really nice spike with AMPA blockers. And this is a somatic recording. So from the soma, it looks like it's coming out of nothing, out of zero, meaning that the properties of the NMDA receptor channels, in contrast to the textbook view that they need the AMPA to unblock them, just by the regenerative positive feedback they have, this is enough for them to get to the negative slope regime and to initiate this full-blown spike. I will show the subtype now. So, of course, AMPA helps. Yeah, of course, AMPA helps because there is a shift with the AMPA receptor blockers. But again, you can do it without AMPA receptors activated.
One thing that may be so is that the resting membrane potential out at the tips of dendrites might be around minus 55.
More depolarized?
Much more depolarized because there's a very strong H current there.
Not in basal dendrites.
Not in the basal
Mike.
Dendrites.
Okay. Almost no H currents in basal dendrites. So, but this has really, I think, important implications to what we think about silent synapses, right? So silent synapses are not really silent. If you have a patch of, you know, spatiotemporally synapses that, you know, out of learning rules were created or are silent, they are not silent. They can contribute a large voltage if they are activated together. So what about the receptors? We know that NMDA receptor channels are built from an obligatory subunit, the NR1, and one of the NR2 subunits. And here we had we have available blockers for the NR2B and NR2A subunits. And we can see that NR2B blockers do not do much, okay? But NR2A blockers, it's almost like putting an MK or an APV to the slice. So this is a clue of what subunit is there in basal dendrites, but also a clue that since we know that NR2A channels are synaptic channels and not extrasynaptic channels like the NR2B, probably all the effect is really through the synaptic activation of receptors at the synapse and not at the...
A and B are both...
The C is yeah.
C and D are much less than A and B are both...
So in the barrel cortex, from your data, it looks that the NR2C at least is more abundant than NR2A and NR2B. But is there any blocker for NR2C, Mike? Pity. Okay.
Don't go for another half an hour.
Half an hour?
No. Less than half an hour.
Oh, I have to go less than half an hour?
But the point is that Jackie was going to tell us at the end things that are of great importance to the holidays. And these are things that are actually more important.
Okay, so let me go faster then. Okay, so I hope I convinced you. I wanted to bring that just to show really the mechanism of the spike and to convince you that the main charge carrier is really through the NMDA receptor channel. And this is not a semantic thing because I think there is a really big difference if a spike or a nonlinearity is generated by voltage-gated calcium channel. This would give you a propagating a regional spike compared to an NMDA spike, which is really tied to the activated site, which is a more localized spike. And we can see that here, that an NMDA spike is really localized within 20. If you look at the calcium transient, it is localized within 20 micron along a segment of a dendrite. So it can be. It's not necessarily. It can be very localized. And so this, okay, we can talk about the implications later, but just briefly, burst firing, yes, it does provoke burst firing. What we did here is injected an in vivo-like activation pattern. These were neurons that we recorded under in vivo conditions and took the spike train and the subthreshold voltage and used that to stimulate our neurons. And we can see here that our neurons can, when we stimulate with higher frequencies, there is a tendency to generate the NMDA spike and to create a burst. Here we can see it very nicely. Stimulating the dendrite. What we injected into the soma is this just a subthreshold waveform. Just an enlargement of this part to show the burst that's there. And we strike a difference. We can see here that actually when we put APV, the firing is really very different. It is no longer sensitive to the frequency of activation. And instead of being as bursts of action potentials, now you can see that the output is a single action potential. So let me skip this. And I wanted to talk about GABA a bit, but I will skip it. I will talk about this. Now I'm coming to the question, how many synapses you need to generate this really very big event in the dendrites, and it is a big event also in the soma. So now we have also experimental data with two photon uncaging on two specific spines, but here I'm showing modeling, and what we see is if the activation is concentrated spatiotemporally into a spot, then only you need only seven synapses to generate this spike. But not necessarily, you do not necessarily have to really have such a concentrated spatiotemporal input. If you distribute the input randomly along the entire branch, the number of synapses that are needed increases to around 20. But if one does a spine count, it is less than 5% of the total synapses to the branch. So we did investigate this. There is a large time window at which they can come just because of the characteristics of the NMDA spike. So even within 20, 30 milliseconds, you can still have a nice interaction between these events. Of course, smaller time window, you need less conductance spread. Okay. I'll skip that. And maybe I'll skip that. And I really want to talk about the tough dendrites, so to come to the biophysical scheme I wanted to give. So up to now, I talked about a little bit about the apical dendrites, the basal dendrites, and the state of the art when we started the tuft dendritic project was that not only tuft and basal dendrites are segregated in terms of the input they get, also they are segregated in terms of the regenerative event they use, with NMDA spike using basal dendrites using NMDA spikes and apical dendrites using calcium spikes. Nevertheless, these conclusions came about the apical dendrites using recordings up to the main bifurcation point. And as I said at the beginning, dendrites are non-homogeneous. And we really, it was an extrapolation we did. We really did not know what's happening in the tough dendrite with direct recordings. So we decided to revisit our view and to try and record from tough dendrites. And this is the project I would like to show. So again, using the same method, we could record robustly from tough dendrites all the way up to layer one. And first experiment we did, obvious experiment, is of course to inject current, record from the main bifurcation point and from a tough dendrite, and inject current at the proximal point and record the voltage here and at the more distal as well. When one does that, here we can see that calcium spikes were initiated at the main bifurcation point and backpropagated nicely to the tuft regions. You can see that for the red recording. We just verified what we already knew for more than 10 years, that the main charge carrier is via voltage-gated calcium channels, although sodium channels also contributed somehow. This is old news. The shock came when we did the inverse experiment, where we now injected current at the more distal regions and recorded voltage distally and proximally. In this case, here you can see the result. What we had is a really small blip of regenerativity at the distal region, which attenuated considerably at the more proximal regions. Pharmacology, when we did the same pharmacology, we came to the conclusion that this small blip is actually a sodium spikelet, a small sodium spikelet, and not the calcium spike. So what we can see here is actually that the tuft region is starting to look similar to the basal region, okay? So it cannot initiate a full-blown calcium spike, and actually it can initiate, I will show, a regenerative sodium spikelet, which was very variable and very small from dendrite to dendrite. So this is really very reminiscent to the basal tree. And we can see here that vast majority of sodium spikes, of calcium spikes, were initiated at the more proximal regions of the main bifurcation point and the first branches of the tuft. In contrast to that, pure sodium spikelets initiated almost exclusively on the more distal portions of the tuft. Almost no calcium regenerativity in the distal portions of the tuft region. Sodium regenerativity, as I said, was small and variable. Here you can see the amplitude distribution of sodium spikelets in tuft, different tuft dendrites. We don't know the reason for that. It might be that we record, it might be that there are strong and weak dendrites, as Jeff found in CA1 regions. But it might be that technically that we actually record that the spike initiated more distal to our site. But in any case, we haven't seen really full-blown, large-size sodium spikelets in tuft regions. Also, you have a distribution. Okay, so this starts to look like, very similar to a basal dendrite. So we wanted to know whether the synaptic events are also how strong they are and how strong they attenuate from the tuft region to the main bifurcation point. And we repeated the sucrose experiment. And you can see here that, again, these unitary events are large locally and attenuate significantly as they are recorded at the main bifurcation point. So actually, and the attenuation is, again, attenuation ratio was about 40. So what we can see here is that the relationship of the distal unitary event at the tuft to the main bifurcation are similar to the relationship of the unitary events of the at the main bifurcation to the soma and of the basal dendrites to the soma. This was a relationship that we could see. And so the situation up to now is that there is a really strong attenuation of synaptic events to the main bifurcation to the calcium initiation zone. We have seen that sodium electrogenesis is weak and calcium electrogenesis is not present at this dendrite. So this brought up the issue that maybe it is really very similar to basal dendrites, and actually that the main regenerativity here would be via an NMDA spike. So what we did is an experiment where we, again, instead of injecting current, stimulated the axons that innervate a Taft branch. And we have here the somatic recording and the dendritic recording. In this case, when we do that under synaptic stimulation, we can initiate very nicely this plateau potential, regenerative plateau potentials. No, but it's easier. If you block GABA, it's easier. Yeah. Here we can see same spike from a different recording. Black is APV, which blocks completely the spike. And here you can see the current voltage relationship in control conditions and with APV. And with uncaging experiments, we can more quantitatively define it. We can see that nickel, cadmium, and TTX do not block the spike. You can still see a full-blown, but that you have a shift in the laser intensity, meaning that they do contribute some, but not contributing the main charge carrier. With the Taft region, we know that it is a more calcium creature compared to the basal. So there is a gradient from the main bifurcation all the way up to the Taft, and the more distal you are, the less calcium you have, okay? And the less contribution of voltage-gated calcium channels you will have to the NMDA spike. So at the beginning, it would be a mixed spike, and the more distal you would be more pure NMDA and less calcium contribution. How much time I have? -5 minutes? Okay.
But that's all right, the theoreticians, -5 minutes.
Okay, so what I'm skipping is actually the interactions between the Taft activation and the main bifurcation. And the idea was that how would the calcium spike would initiate at the main bifurcation zone? And what we see is that the because of the huge attenuation of this synaptic event, one needs the amplification through the NMDA spike to initiate the calcium spike. And what we are exploring is the interaction between the calcium spike and the NMDA spike, but I don't have time to show that. So maybe I will show two more slides, and I will show Sarah the other stuff afterward. So what I would like to show here is this is a modeling we did using our experimental data. We did see that NMDA spike crucially contribute to the initiation of the calcium spike. But the question was, how crucial is the NMDA spike for the initiation? Is it obligatory, or can just AMPA synapses, AMPA-type synapses, do well? So what we did here is compared the number of synapses needed to initiate a calcium spike, okay, in two cases, when synapses were allowed to initiate an NMDA spike, or when they it was not allowed. So black, when you are allowed to initiate an NMDA spike, and white, when you are not allowed. In gray, you can see the total number of synapses in the compartment, okay, that we counted. Now, we explored various scenarios. In this case, I'm presenting synapses which were activated by branch order, as you can see here in red. First branch order, second, third. These are the total number of synapses in the branch, in the compartment. And we activated the synapses randomly. Random activation of synapses in the compartment. So when we are close to the calcium zone, you can see that the number of synapses needed to initiate a calcium spike with or without an NMDA spike are quite close. But when we go to further away to higher order bifurcation, we can see that the number of synapses needed to initiate the calcium spike increases exponentially with the branch order. So if you compare this number to this number, okay, you have an exponential increase of the number of AMPA synapses needed for calcium spike initiation when you activate the TAFT. While if you look at the black boxes, you can see that when we allow for the NMDA spike to occur, actually the number of synapses that are needed is quite constant throughout all locations in the TAFT tree. Interestingly, at the more distal locations, the number of synapses that are needed exceeds the number of synapses in the compartment when one uses AMPA-only synapses. And this is because of saturation. So actually here, the passive case, if you take synapses that are activated distally, in the passive case, you will not be able to fire the calcium electrogenesis at the main apical dendrite.
The number of synapses activated?
Yes, here we just took zero time, yeah. So we randomly activated the synapses synchronously.
And so 600 means you need to activate 600 synapses
at the same time? Yes. And regenerativity, yes. You have a large contribution to the main apical voltage. Prolonged large contribution. Yes. That's a lot. Yeah. This is what you need if you activate them without any structure. I mean, random activation without any substructure. So the distal you go, actually, that's the point. Here's the deal. The more distal you are, the less number of synapses you need to evoke the NMDA spike, but its contribution to the main apical is smaller. So you need a higher number of this NMDA spike quanta to still activate the calcium spike initiation zone. Yes. If they occur in vivo or not? I'll tell you what, from what, these results really are, we should worry about, because what I'm showing here is that we know that very important axons and are coming, all the feedback connections are coming to the TAFT. So this is a very important information. But from the other hand, we know that all these synapses, all this information really would be lost if it would not be amplified. Because as you can see here, if you just take the passive case, you are not going to fire the soma. Because if you are not going to fire the calcium electrogenesis, you will not fire the soma. So this information will be lost. My bet would be, yes, you need the NMDA electrogenesis. It's there to help you fire the calcium electrogenesis and to help you fire the axosomatic output. If you don't have it, you're in a deep trouble. No, the experimental evidence is there. You know how much attenuation you have? But don't forget that if you have NMDA electrogenesis, you can spread them much more. We just didn't explore it here, but you can really spread them.
Here's a related question. If you inject a constant current into the near the bifurcation up there,
The main bifurcation?
The main bifurcation. Do you get repetitive calcium spikes? You do, don't you?
You do.
Yes. Because a lot of times what's happening is there's a lot of incoming input. And so it may not be that you have to time things right. It may mean that what you want to do is determine the rate of those calcium spikes, but it's a constant injection of current.
Yeah. So one more point here is just activation of distal synapses. Many times what you have, and it was shown for the interaction between the backpropagating action potential and the calcium spike. Mind you, to initiate a calcium spike, you need a lot of synapses activated spatiotemporally at a short time window. A really large number of synapses. So, but you can decrease this number of synapses a lot if you have, for example, if you inject voltage either by backpropagating action potential or by other means. So here, if you, for example, pair activation of various pathways, you are going to decrease the number of synapses from each pathway to be activated. I think there is no way around it. You need a threshold current in order to reach to a threshold voltage to initiate the calcium spike. That's biophysics. How you get it? There are many ways to skin this cat.
Well, an interesting question would be, given the total number of synapses existing in the article, and at what rate would they need, kind of background rate, would they need to fire in order to allow for the transmission of the smaller? So you could, if your system is constantly near to the threshold because of background activity, then activating just a few more synapses would be enough for the calcium spike to occur, right? So it would be, if you consider that all these synapses fire at a small rate, spontaneously.
The apical synapses, you mean?
Synapses rather than like being just silent, they could fire at a small rate spontaneously because of spontaneous background activity.
Yes.
Then maybe it would decrease this number by quite a bit before.
Yeah, also, this is really an estimate of the number of synapses that have to be activated simultaneously. In your experiments, when you trigger an NMDS, do you think you are using 100 synaptic inputs to achieve that in an experiment?
No.
Or that they are clustered, that's why it's not.
No, sure.
So I think
that's
the point. Why,
so this is the discussion, really. Whether they are clustered or not, where they are activated more proximally, more distally, what is the voltage, and we know, and modulation. I mean, this portion really receives cholinergic and serotonergic modulation, so we really do not know in vivo how many synapses you need. But I do know that electrogenesis through calcium and sodium is very low. And I do know that the linear case is problematic.
But you know, if you have just regular synaptic currents happening, the amount of current that goes inject down to the bifurcation is going to depend on the local voltage. That's the nonlinearity. So maybe you don't even ever need an NMDA spike. You just need to amplify with the NMDA channels the total
current
that's flowing down over a period
of
time.
Yeah, you can have many regimes from boosting, you know, from a boosting regime to a spike regime to a self-triggering regime. There are many regimes. Yeah.
In terms of this, I mean, Jeff told me 2 days ago, he told me that when he records from layer 5 pyramidal tufts, that he finds a resting potential of minus 55, and then if he puts in a blocker of H current, it goes immediately to minus 7.
So
that there's an H current,
there's
an active current that's contributing.
The tuft has a huge concentration of IH channels, and it is constantly depolarized. I don't know in vivo what's happening, but this is what we have in a slice. So there is, and this was published long ago, there is, if you record from, even not a tuft, now we have the tuft recordings, but from when we recorded from distal apical dendrites and the soma, you can even reach a 10 millivolt difference between somatic resting potential and distal apical resting potential.
You you talked about even more. But Jeff just told me, suggested even
No, I think this is what you had. Because layer 5 pyramidal neurons have a more depolarized anyway resting potential compared to layer 4, for example.
In your graph up there, you have 2,000 spines in the first fibrillation.
Basically, half the paired cup. Because it is a fat region, so you have more membrane. In this region.
So
Yeah. I don't know that we are great anatomists, but this is matching nicely the Larkman numbers from 84, I think.
This is a model of a layer 5. Basically, it looks like you're assuming it has about 20,000 spines altogether, about 20%.
Yes. Yes, about between 10 to 20% would be in the tuft. Yeah.
Okay. The other thing that's implied by this whole scheme is that strategic inhibition will decapitate.
Okay, so, yeah. Inhibition. I didn't get into inhibition, but I think inhibition here is very important. Timing of inhibition, the location of inhibition, this would change the whole picture around, for sure. And we have some data to show, but I don't have time.
There's a question based on ignorance, but what is possible to see in vivo? See this calcium regenerative event at the branch point in some type of in vivo?
Well, people did.
It's a question based on ignorance.
Okay, so here's the deal. People did record already calcium spikes in vivo, I think 10 years ago even, okay? From layer 5 pyramidal neurons, it was Tang's group, David Tang's group that recorded from a layer 5 pyramidal neurons with sharp electrodes from the apical dendrites in vivo. And also it was recorded from, a complex spike from dendrites, Bujaki's group from CA1 pyramidal neurons. So you can see that in vivo. Now, what's the correlation between these spikes and a specific behavior or a specific computation? I think really no one knows. And this is one of the challenges, I think, of dendritic people to show what are the possible contribution of people recorded that more than 10 years ago already. Not correlated to specific behavior. It was anesthetized rat, not related to specific behavior or understanding a bit more what's doing. No, but it happens spontaneously in vivo. You can record it. Obviously, the NMDA spike would be very problematic to record because it would be more similar to an up and down state. It is more a prolonged spike, but I'm sure that if you would block NMDA in vivo, you just shut down much of your activity. And I think this also was shown already for the visual cortex long, long ago, but by at least two groups, that you can change the receptive fields if you block the NMDA conductances, much more than what you would expect from the 10 or 20% NMDA that you see in a normal EPSP. It is really a conspicuous effect when you put NMDA blockers to a normal cortex. Okay, so... I will leave you with the scheme. Okay. So I'll finish it, I think. And can I? Okay. So I would like to propose a biophysical scheme. Is that thin dendrites can locally integrate their information either linearly or depending on the situation with local NMDA spikes. So this would be true for distal tough dendrites and for basal dendrites. These two compartments would further integrate, the tough dendrite would integrate the information at the calcium spike region and basal dendrites at the somatic region. The axosomatic region and the distal calcium spike region can interact bilaterally with propagating spikes for propagation of a calcium spike and backward propagation of a sodium spike to generate the final output of the neuron. Now, what I would like to say is that, I'll skip that. So this type of neuron can actually have different modes of integration. It can, and the mode of integration will depend on, of course, the wiring diagram, which is very important, whether there is clustered input into a certain dendrite, meaning whether a relevant information is clustered onto a dendrite, a subdendrite, a branch or region, the activation pattern, and of course the degree of activation. And you can have a random innervation pattern, or you can have a functional clustering pattern into this neuron. And actually, I would like to show two or three slides. Here, I'm sure everybody knows this work from the fly. Just briefly, I'm not going to go into details, to show that actually dendrites, information is clustered into dendrites, okay? Now, in the mammalian cortex, a recent study also shows clustering of information into dendrites. So they don't stress that, but what they show hotspots which are tuned to a certain direction. And so this can come about just by clustering of inputs. And they call it, they call the hotspot, what did they say? What is a hotspot? That was the question. And is it a single synapse, which is alluded in the text, but actually it's not a single synapse. And people who read the comment of the first author in this side, the third reviewer side, he also claims, and we did some modeling to show that actually this cluster is at least composed of something like 10 synapses, 10 to 20 synapses. So here you have first proof of clustering of information into a subdendritic region, okay? So these things can happen. For example, such a clustering would easily, can easily provoke an NMDA spike, no problem. And this can amplify the information, okay, to a preferred direction. This is a layer 2-3 neuron from mice visual cortex. Yes. Yes. So, first of all, they show that the final in this case the tuning is not via a single branch or a single sub-branch. I think it is a summation of the whole story. But here also, when they put APV, they have a dramatic effect on the voltage. Okay. So I will leave you with this. And I think the future will tell what's going to happen.